Coming up, filmmaker Adam Rifkin joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So great to see you. We had a couple weeks off.
We did. It was weird.
I hated it.
I feel very out of my routine.
I know. The holidays are meant for all the things you're going to do. I got one thing accomplished.
Oh, there you go.
I'm just bragging, but I bought a photo album, and I managed to do one
page.
I got it filled with the 80s. So that was about it. All the rest of the books and the photos, I still have 18,000 to go.
Boxes of photos, right?
So I got that done. And then the other thing I accomplished is you were following. You love to cook. I love to cook.
Yes. Oh, yes.
I have been perfecting my matzo ball soup.
Yes, you have.
And it's been such a fun journey. And I have loved talking with everyone about this. I've made all sorts of things in my life. I've never had the input on creating the matzo balls. I mean, it's like a bunch of pesky Jewish grandmothers.
It started with them just criticizing your spelling because you'd spelled it.
First of all, like, I'm not Jewish. I know I look Jewish. Everyone thinks I'm Jewish. I'm Italian, but I misspelled matzah.
Yep.
Then the second time I made the matzo ball, I was trying to lighten them up, and so I was experimenting. So I put sourdough bread in the matzo ball. Oh my goodness! Well, of course, I was told the whole point of matzah is that it's supposed
unleavened.
To be unleavened,
right?
And I don't have the chicken fat yet, but I have nailed the broth, and I took pictures of how it's really quite a process.
I'm fascinated. You put dill in your broth?
Yeah, the dill is killer.
It is unusual.
It is the kiss. It's got to be fresh dill.
Of course.
So I have nailed the dill. And it's funny, my manager called me on like New Year's. He's like, I'm coming home from vacation. Can I come over for soup? So everybody.
I almost showed up on your doorstep for soup.
So I have nailed the soup. And he says my broth is on point.
Nice.
And I've been working on my little secret ingredients. I do add spices and stuff for making the chicken, and it's all on my Facebook page. I have not nailed the balls yet. The first, what is that? Why is that funny?
Oh, I don't know.
No, I'm kidding. But the first attempt were dense, and I don't have the right bowls and balls. But
I'm just sitting here blushing.
So the third time, I got to go to the Green Blast and get the chicken fat.
Oh,
because I
got to
get the chicken fat, and then everybody keeps talking about the soda water that I got to put soda water in.
Oh, and the matzo ball, sure.
But nobody
also
says
not
how
Jewish,
much.
But I know about these things. Yes.
So they keep saying a little soda water and then 2 tablespoons of chicken fat. I've been using 2 tablespoons of olive oil.
Of course, because you're Italian.
So that's also what I had on hand.
Uh-huh.
So I will get the chicken fat, I swear. So next time, my goal, I only have one goal for 2018. Here it is. You know, listen, I'm one of the few people who I achieved my New Year's resolution was not to watch the news.
I know. I'm so impressed by that.
I don't watch the news anymore, which means that I have, unfortunately, a lot of free time on my hands.
No,
I got a lot of free time. So I don't watch the news anymore. In fact, as a treat, I think it was yesterday. I think as a treat, I watched CBS News at 6:30, and I was astonished. I'm like, oh, I'm not missing. This is so kooky.
No.
It's a long way from Walter Cronkite. Yeah. But my goal for 2018, aside from making our show a continued success, and we've got so many cool guests coming up, but I want to perfect my matzo ball soup, and then I want to serve it to Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner.
Oh my gosh.
And if they call it
soup, I love
soup,
that goal.
Then that's it. Then I have achieved. That's all I want for 2018.
Boom.
Small goals, everyone.
Boom.
That's my. How about you? Do you have any? No. I pray that Ileana will talk less and we'll get more time to talk about my decorating and my jewelry.
Exactly. Let's talk about me.
Is there anything you can't do? Archery? You're good at archery. You're good at everything. I love following the pictures.
Oh my gosh. The pictures are hilarious.
Low self-esteem.
Oh my gosh.
Today I've dismantled a... No, you always have.
But like you talked about the plum jam, and because I'd given you plum jam a couple weeks ago.
Amazing plum jam.
And I said, oh, and you know, I picked those plums too, which is a little over the top for what, even for me.
They're delicious. Listen, some people do a lot of things not very well.
Right.
You know, right. So that's the thing about Tamara. You do a lot of things very, very well.
Thank you. That's so impressive. Thank you.
You know?
Thank you.
So
I appreciate that. So a couple of things, because we're going live. We're live right now. So a couple of things. I do want to talk about the fact that we got put on the women film
podcast,
badass women film podcast list.
That's us.
Which was amazing. I think we both put it on our Twitter feed. It happened like a week ago. So check that out. I can't find the picture right now.
Thank you. Wow. Wait a minute. That means we have someone in the control booth. I love
it. We do. We're official badasses, you and I.
Well, we're great.
I love it.
The show is developed. Being a lot of followers, and we've got some. And as I said, January, we're trying to just do things that we love, films and film inspiration. And we're going to be talking to a lot of writers this month. We've got, of course, Adam today. We have Mitch Glazer.
Yes.
We're hoping to have my friend Stephen Rogers, screenwriter of I, Tonya, up for a Golden Globe on Sunday. Just talking about writing and film inspiration. And
I love talking about two writers because I think they're really interesting people.
Yeah.
Obviously articulate usually and enjoy talking about what they do. So, I love that we're focusing on writers. Speaking about the Golden Globes on Sunday. Okay, so you know that there's this movement. I know we just have a minute or two to do this. But so people are going to wear black in solidarity for the Me Too movement. What do you think about it?
I mean, I think it's great. It's it's nice to have something that's symbolic and awareness. Yep. You know, it's always you can kind of be cynical about it. Hopefully it's more than just wearing a black dress, you know.
Right.
I think that's the, you know, that's the thing. It's like what will they say in their speeches, and the door is open to people talking about it, but you don't want it to come off like, oh, there goes Hollywood with their causes and it True. Coming off as a show,
right.
Of something that, you know, is obviously a very serious subject. And for people that don't look good in black, I mean, that's really a tragedy.
An even more serious subject.
I'm kidding. You could just hear the actresses going, and thank God I look killer in black.
What if someone shows up in a dress that's not black?
It's going to be like Jezebel. They'll be shunned. No. This is Hollywood.
That's one possibility.
Everyone will be wearing black. You wouldn't have nobody. It's like everybody suddenly, that's how you learn the colors that you're like. Is Dusty Rose in? Because everyone's got Dusty Rose on.
Yeah.
I like the old days of, you know, in the
dressing 70s. Yourself?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, me too.
Cher and
Bjork.
Sharon Stone, remember coming in her
Gap t-shirt. Yes.
I miss the individuality of it.
I do too. We've talked about that before. Yeah, it's too perfect.
It's a little bit too stylized and, you know, it's going to be a very interesting year, and I have been invited to a very highfalutin party.
I cannot wait to hear the stories about the highfalutin party.
But this year, I feel like it's tough because I do, well, every year I have, I have friends that are up for awards.
Yeah.
And I am a member of the Academy, and I dutifully look at all the films. I watch all the films. I watch all the foreign films. I'm one of the people left. Like, you actually go out and watch them? I'm like,
of course.
I try to go to the Q&As. And I listen to the films, and sometimes I don't like the film. I try not to be too critical, you know. But I take my voting very, very seriously.
I would hope you would.
And I try, you know, and you look for films that really, you know, that haven't found a place. I mean, the one movie I keep promoting is Movie Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, Annette Bening. I mean, I'm like, I don't know what this poor woman has to do to win an award. Because she's amazing in this film. I like Three Billboards quite a bit. Mm-hmm. As I said, I liked I, Tonya. I think that's a little bit under the radar.
Yeah.
It's a black comedy. I thought The Phantom Thread was fantastic. The Florida Project, very interesting. Call Me by Your Name, very interesting. You know, so there's interesting movies that are out there, but it's very, very hard not to pull for my favorites. And yes, anyone who says that there is not a pull for someone who over the years,
right,
it seems like it's their turn.
Yep.
That's a factor.
Right. Of course. So, of course. You know. Well, I can't wait to hear about what your party's going to be like. Let's bring in Adam now, though.
I can't wait either. Hopefully I'll be able to get in. That's always my fear. Be like, but I was invited, I swear. Let's talk about Adam. Adam is who I just met recently. You shouldn't invite me to a party because I'll hit you up to be on my podcast. Adam is a writer, director, and a filmmaker who's made films like The Dark Backward, Giuseppe Makes a Movie, which is a documentary. I was watching that online. Of course, Detroit Rock City. He also wrote Mouse Hunt, Small Soldiers, and his newest project, which we're going to talk about, The Last Movie Star, starring his childhood hero, Burt Reynolds. Anyone who gets to work with their childhood hero is my kind of person. Welcome, Adam Rifkin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, truth be told, how did we meet?
We met through our mutual friend, Josh Olson.
Yes.
At Larry Karaszewski's house.
We love Josh, and Josh was on the show, too. And then as you were walking out, I said, would Adam ever do my show? It's all I go to parties for, just to have a couple drinks and then hit people up.
That's
well,
not true.
I was so flattered that you asked. Of course, I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, we have to talk about the crazy thing we have in common. Do you the show, the television show, Action?
Yes, we must discuss that.
So let's, because to see, this was probably my favorite joke. I think one of my favorite jokes of movies, of that, of Action, which is the premise is Jay Mohr is a producer and he purchases the wrong script. He wants to buy your script.
So as it went, now, I'll just sort of paint it for you from my point of view.
Yes!
I did not know anybody involved with the show at all.
So
right?
So awesome.
I heard someone said to me, there's this new show on Fox about Hollywood, and there's a couple characters that sound suspiciously like you in the show. So the way it goes, Jay Mohr plays like a Joel Silver type producer, as
yes.
you know.
Yes.
And he confuses Adam Rafkin and Alan Rifkin, both writers, but the one he hires turns out to be the sitcom writer, not the movie writer.
Yes.
So the joke is, I hired the wrong Jew.
Yes.
And I was, of course, flattered that... Well, first of all, I didn't want to be too presumptuous in assuming that it was a joke only of me.
Yeah.
But I thought that anyway. I thought it was a joke about me. But also there's the famous director, Alan Rafkin...
Yes.
Who directed The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, among many other episodes of classic television shows. But anyway, so when the show aired, the pilot episode aired, and I watched it, I found out who the showrunner was, Chris Thompson, I
Chris
think.
Chris Thompson, yeah. Now deceased.
Yeah, and I called him up after the show had aired, and the assistant answered, hello, Chris Thompson's office. I said, this is Adam Rifkin calling for Chris Thompson. And she went, uh-oh. And she said, hold on. Never met Chris Thompson. So about a minute later, Chris Thompson comes on the line. I still have never met him. I mean, he died before I ever got a chance to meet him. I mean, he came on the phone laughing heartily.
Yeah.
He said, I've been waiting for this call for 6 months.
Oh, God.
I said, first of all, thank you for... acknowledging me in your TV show. I said, I think you and me and my mom got the joke. Why did you do it? He said, I just thought it was funny at 3 a.m. when I was writing it.
And that was it?
That's my side of the story.
Well, if the show had continued, they probably would have, you know, I mean, obviously we were 20 years ahead of our time. But it was supposed to be like a post, I think, a Larry Sanders.
Right.
But darker.
Yeah.
I think that's what they were going for, and we should have been on HBO, but we weren't.
He told me that if it goes a second season, he would like me to direct some episodes. I said I'd be happy to, and it didn't go a second season, as you know.
Unfortunately, yeah, yeah,
it was a great show.
Oh my God, I know, it was completely crazy with all the Buddy Hackett. There needs to be a documentary just about the 13 episodes and
absolutely
surviving it. And
I did meet the guy who played the Alan Rifkin, Adam Rafkin character.
Yeah,
and a very nice guy.
Yes, I forget his real name. Jared Paul.
Jared Paul. Yeah, very nice guy.
Very funny.
Yeah, we bonded over that moment. Yeah.
I'm sure that people think he really was Adam Rifkin.
Maybe.
But anyway, that's one of my favorite showbiz jokes, and that's what. So thank you for playing along with me.
Thank you.
Okay, now to more serious, the whole reason you're here. What was the first film you saw, and who took you to see it?
Okay, well, I don't have a clean answer to this question.
Yes.
Because my memory's a little fuzzy.
Okay.
But I can tell you there's two films in particular that are key films in my early development.
Yes.
That changed my life.
Yes.
One I saw at an age that was too young to remember how old I was. And then one was when I hit about 12.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that I saw first that changed everything for me was Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
The Bela Lugosi, the classic Bela Lugosi version.
Yeah.
Todd Browning's Dracula. And that, I was so, I had to be 4 or 5, maybe even younger. I don't know. But I was so taken with the imagery.
Yeah.
And with his performance and with his eyes and with the mystery of it that I fell not only in love with that film, but I fell in love with monster movies in general. Mm-hmm. And my first love of movies was a love of monster movies because of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Also, at the same time, my grandfather, and it may be the reason I saw the movie, but my grandfather turned me on to monster movies by buying me an issue at around that time of Famous Monsters magazine.
Oh.
At a grocery store.
Uh-huh.
And I loved the imagery of all the monsters. So that started me on a lifelong love of monster movies. I'm from Chicago. And where I saw all the monster movies that that I ever had seen,
yeah,
was on a show called Svengoolie.
Oh, God. I love it.
Svengoolie, who is still doing it and is now coast to coast on MeTV,
yes,
was the local Chicago monster movie host when I was growing up.
Love it.
And he is where I first saw all the Universal monster movies.
Yeah.
I saw all the Hammer horror films. I saw all the Japanese giant monster movies.
Mm-hmm.
I saw all the AIP drive-in movies. I saw them all on Svengoolie.
Wow.
And I've since become buddies with Svengoolie. His name is Rich Coase. He's a great guy. I tried to actually, there was a point where I was making this movie called Detroit Rock City, which I know you brought up earlier.
Yes. Great film.
Thank you. It's set in that era when I was growing up in the 70s, and I wanted to license a clip from an old episode of Svengoolie. That scene got cut, so it didn't end up happening, but that's how I got to know him.
Uh-huh.
And he's a great guy. But anyway, he was my original film school, Svengoolie.
Yeah.
And now that eventually evolved into a love of all kinds of movies, and that's where I come to the second movie, which is not, I know the question was the first movie you ever saw.
No, it's
but this
okay.
was another milestone movie for me.
Yeah.
When I was about, I had to be, I guess it was about 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
And that totally shifted my perspective on movies. No longer were movies merely
right.
cool monsters and something fun to watch and makeup effects. And it was no longer frivolous. Suddenly, a movie reached into my soul and my psyche and changed the way I looked at human beings and emotions and life. You know, it just changed my whole outlook on life. So that movie then got me off onto this love of all movies, all kinds of movies. And that's when I became a real student of just cinema in general.
Mm-hmm.
So monster movies first, thanks to Dracula. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest opened me up to all movies.
It's interesting that you mentioned Cuckoo's Nest, because even though you wouldn't think that that's a movie for a child, he really is this kind of anti-hero. And if you feel different at all, I could see why you would gravitate.
Loved it, yeah.
Towards
him. Totally connected with McMurphy. You know?
Yeah.
In the same way, though, I connected to all those great monsters.
Right.
Like the Universal Monster, the Universal Monsters, I'm not, of course, the first person to say this. I mean, this is something that people have talked about ad nauseum. But all those great Universal Monsters had tremendous pathos.
Yes.
You related to them. You felt sorry for them. They were these misunderstood
right.
Freaks who were not, you know, who it was not their fault.
I know.
That they were placed in this judgmental, harsh, cruel world.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of kids related to those monsters when they were growing up.
Yeah.
And so McMurphy, I felt, is kind of a similar character in a way. He's a misunderstood monster. And also, they were all kids in that ward, you know?
Yeah.
And but the real monster was Nurse Ratched, of course. She was the scariest monster of all.
She was well, it's interesting with the movie The Shape of Water, because he's talking about the creature of Black Lagoon. And why do you think – it's so interesting. We have so many superhero movies, but superheroes aren't as fun to get behind as Frankenstein and Dracula and all of those.
In my humble opinion, I agree with you. But generally speaking, today, that's not the case. Generally speaking, it seems as though the audiences at large connect more to the superheroes than the misunderstood monsters. I love monsters personally.
Me too.
But I also, I mean, listen, I love all kinds of movies, and I love good comic book movies, and I don't like bad comic book movies, and I love good monster movies, and I don't love bad monster movies. So I get it. There's different tastes for different folks, but I would love to see monster movies make a comeback, but we'll see. I loved The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
I thought The Shape of Water, absolutely, and it's no surprise. I mean, Guillermo is such a talented guy, such a sweet guy, and you really, he's such a, you know, you can see that he loves the monster movies, which we all know.
Yes.
But he also has such a great heart, and he put that into the movie, and it's so poetic. It's such a beautiful Beauty and the Beast kind of movie. I thought it was great.
Well, I think it's that thing that we now, you probably didn't realize as a kid, but you see it as a grown up looking at it, that there's a sense of sadness in Frankenstein,
without question.
All these people,
all of them have that, you know, they're all these misunderstood outcasts that, as an audience member, you can, if you in any way, which I like to think most people can relate to moments of being an outcast.
Yeah.
Maybe some people aren't an outcast all the time, but sometimes, you know, it's easy to paint things in black and white in a movie.
Right.
Like, you know, like the girls from Carrie, the bad girls from Carrie, you probably in the universe of the movie Carrie, they don't feel isolated and lonely because that's Carrie's job in that movie.
Right.
But in life, most people have those moments, those insecure moments. And so these misunderstood monsters are a great connecting point for people to relate to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We saw them on TV. Like you said, it was Saturday afternoons were relegated to Godzilla, and, you know, all of those movies. So when you were growing up, I mean, what's interesting about you is you write, you direct, and you act. So did you have...
Well, I don't act...
And you wrote a book.
I don't act well. I'm not an actor.
But did you... What was your... When you were a kid, did you think, oh, I want to write stories, or...
I wanted to make movies. That's all I wanted to do from...
Me too.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know what... I just want in.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm going to get in.
I felt the same way. I didn't know when I first...
I want to be in show business.
Yeah. When I first wanted to make movies, I didn't know what a director was. I didn't know what a producer was. I didn't necessarily even know movies were written before you shoot them. I just knew I love movies. I want to make them. So I started making movies with my dad's home movie camera at a very young age, 6 or 7. And I would use my sister in them or my friends.
I love it.
And I would make them all the time. And I just did it because I loved it.
Okay, now I got to stop you because I'm fascinated by this one question.
Yeah.
Because this is like what all directors do.
Yeah.
What is the drive to force people to be in your movie and make them and have that confidence and force them to act out a story that you have written? And they do it.
That's a great question.
But where does that come from?
It must come from some sort of arrogance. It must come from some bizarre,
there isn't
ill-earned confidence. that people have who just want to make movies and tell stories, and you just by sheer will and force of personality, you say, okay, you're going to be in this movie. Yeah. You're going to stand there. You're going to wear this. You're going to say this. And they say, I feel like an idiot. Just do it. It looks good. Just do it.
Yeah.
And that's how you just sort of force it into happening, which is what I would do with my sister and my friends.
They do it.
And also, too, there's the lure, even if it's a Super 8 camera on the back porch, it's still making movies. So there's still a sexy sizzle to it, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's exciting. It's like you grow up and, I remember when I met Martin Scorsese, that's all he did. Made his mom read his movies.
Of course.
There's no difference.
No difference.
He was like, he would draw little pictures and put, you know, his name above the title. And
it's true. That's how I did it. That's how everybody does it. And you know, it's interesting. I had an epiphany when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
In Chicago, they made movies when I was growing up in Chicago. Some of the movies that they were making that were like huge local events, like they shot the Blues Brothers in Chicago, which was very exciting.
Wow. Yeah.
But they shot 16 Candles in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Also Risky Business and stuff like that. But 16 Candles, I was in as an extra because I went to an arts high school,
mm-hmm.
and everybody from the school got to be extras in the movie if they wanted to be. And I wanted to watch movies get made. So I wanted to go and see a movie being shot. So I signed up to be an extra. Footnote, they said to everybody, show up dressed either like a tough kid or a nerd. And I dressed up in my toughest tough kid outfit. And John Hughes personally picked me to be head nerd. So I misjudged that slightly. But anyway, aside from that, when I was done working as an extra, I went up to John Hughes,
mm-hmm.
And again, ill-earned confidence, you know, and I said to him, I'm going to be a director just like you, and I'm here watching you and learning from you just by watching. Can I come back and shadow you and learn more just by watching? He said, sure, come back whenever you want. So I came back every day and just hung around and watched, which was super nice of him, and I learned so much. And I had this epiphany because all the movies that I was making with my friends mm-hmm. with the little home movie camera, I figured out as I was watching a real movie being made, the principles are exactly the same. The cameras are bigger.
Right.
There's more help.
Right.
But they're the same principles. So that was very educational.
Wow. God, I love that. What a great story. And what was the first, do you remember the first script that you had done? How did you get from Chicago to California?
Well, I made, as I was saying, I went to high school at the Arts High School in Chicago. Right. All my art projects were films. I used filmmaking as my sort of major. I created mm-hmm. that for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have a fantastic film department there, which is great. So I came out here having sort of figured out pretty early on that there's no magic to getting a movie made. You just need the money to make it with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how I figured that out, but I do remember that suddenly hit me that if I had the money to make a movie, I could make a movie tomorrow. So what was the question?
Well, no, you got to California. What I'm going to lead up to is this idea that you were 21 years old and you got a Soldier Planet of the Apes script.
Oh, I'll tell you what happened before that is I made an independent movie before that.
Uh-huh.
That was produced by our mutual friend, Brad Wyman.
Oh.
So I was 20.
Uh-huh.
And I had written... So the first script I ever wrote was a script called The Dark Backward.
Uh-huh.
Which I ultimately got made several years later.
Yes.
But that was the first script I wrote. I did not know how to pursue getting the money to make a movie. I just knew you needed the money to make a movie. So I foolishly... And I mean, there was no internet, so I just went through the Yellow Pages and looked for whoever had the biggest ads, and I figured they had the most money, so I contacted them to see if they would fund my movies, like dentists and lawyers, and that's not how it works, obviously. And a lawyer...
I'm so curious, like, what would you say when you got them on the phone?
I'd say...
I am Adam Rifkin.
I'm Adam Rifkin. I'm a filmmaker. I said I am a filmmaker. I didn't say I want to be a filmmaker. So I said, I'm a filmmaker, and I'm mounting my first film, and I'm hoping that you might want to invest in the film. And they said, we don't do that.
You know,
we're an eye clinic. We don't do that.
Oh my God, I love it.
So, but a lawyer who's now, whose name now escapes me, and it is applicable because of the name of your book and your podcast, a lawyer took pity upon me, and he was a real Hollywood lawyer because he was involved in the deal for Easy Rider.
Oh my God.
So I thought, this is exciting.
Yeah.
That's a great movie. And that's a real movie. So he sat me down. I wish I knew, remembered his name. And he said, you're going about this all wrong.
Aww.
He said, I don't know why he bothered, but he did. It was very sweet.
Well, that's, you're going to see in the book. People, it's, you know, once you make up your mind, it's like people will just be there to help you.
I did find that to be true. And this guy helped. So he said, here's what you got to do. Don't contact lawyers and doctors. He said, there are production companies that do this. That is what they do. You submit your material, they assess it, they decide if they want to fund it. He said, find out who they are, submit your script to them. So at that time, there was a ton of independent film companies, and one of them, which no longer exists, was called Scurus Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And a reader at the company liked the script. He knew the company wouldn't make it, but he gave it to his high school chum, who was 21, 22, had just produced his first movie, Brad Wyman, said, Brad, you should read this. Maybe you'd want to see if you could help get it made. So John Lau gave the script to Brad Wyman. Brad read it, called me in to the office. He was at the time working for a producer named, speaking of, we also talked about Marlon Brando.
Yes.
A producer named Elliot Kastner, who produced a bunch of Brando films and Paul Newman films. And
didn't he do Missouri?
He did Missouri Breaks, right, with Nicholson and Brando. Yeah. So anyway, Brad was working for Elliot, as was Cassian Elwes.
Another great name,
yeah,
Hollywood name.
Yeah, so Cassian was Elliot's stepson. Elliot's no longer with us, sadly. So Cassian and Brad were working for Elliot. So Brad read the script of The Dark Backward, said, let's try and get it funded. We gave it to Elliot. Elliot said, no, this is a weird movie. It's never going to make a penny. I'm not funding this movie. But he said to me and Brad and to Cassian, if you have a movie that might appeal to the kids, meaning teens.
Yeah.
If you have a movie that might appeal to the kids, maybe we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was cranking out tons of little low-budget movies because the home video market was booming. So he said, do you have anything for the kids? And I said, yeah, I do. I have a script that's perfect for the kids. He said, well, bring it in tomorrow. I said, can I bring it in next week? I want to polish it up a little bit. He said, sure. So I didn't have one, but I ran home and I wrote one. And that movie was called Never on Tuesday. And so Brad and Cassian read it. And I don't think Elliot even read it. He just said to them, will the kids like it? Yeah. Okay. You guys can go all make it together. And he gave us like $500,000 and we got to make that movie. That was my first movie.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
What a great story.
Oh, it was,
what were you like on the first day? Were you just like,
an unearned confidence, you know? I was too naive to be too scared, you know? I got scared about day three, but it turned out like a movie. I mean, that movie was my film school. That movie was my film school. And so that got the ball rolling, you know?
Did you make a lot of mistakes with like eye lines?
I made almost every choice I made was a mistake. But I mean, it turned out looking like a movie, and we had a great cast, the three. It was, he said, you know, as few locations and as few characters as possible is what Elliot had said. So it's about three young people who get in a car accident in the middle of the desert. One is driving across country to New York from L.A. One's driving to L.A. from the other side of the country. They crash in the middle of nowhere. They're stuck there waiting for help to arrive. And while they're there, it's like waiting for Godot or Breakfast Club or something, right?
That's a good idea.
It turned out okay. So
I like that idea.
So, but a few different times people drove by and there'd be like a little funny scene and then they wouldn't help them.
Right.
So we got cameos for some of those people because Brad grew up out here, knew a bunch of young famous people, and Cassian was involved in movies since he was a kid, so he knew some famous people. So we got, and I didn't know them, but they agreed to do it, which was great. So Nicolas Cage did a day, and Charlie Sheen did a day, and Cary Elwes did it for Cassie and his brother.
Yeah.
And Emilio Estevez and Judd Nelson and Gilbert Gottfried all
wow.
did a day. And so that was nice.
So then you got to know Judd. And
that's how the Dark Backward came about.
So then he's the star of the Dark Backward, which is, I was watching it on the internet. It's completely crazy with Bill Paxton.
Yeah, it's kind of an oddball movie.
But it's got all these people in it. Wayne Newton is in it, yeah. And James Caan is in it. Yeah. So what was that experience like?
Well, that was, that's my sentimental favorite experience, movie, mm-hmm. everything. Mm-hmm. That's the first script I ever wrote. So what happened was Brad and I, after we made Never on Tuesday, mm-hmm. we decided to continue to try to still try and make The Dark Backward. So Brad, I guess, had given it to Judd Nelson, or Judd just found it and in Brad's office and read mm-hmm. it. I don't remember how it got into Judd Nelson's hands. Mm-hmm. But at that time, Judd Nelson, at a certain budget level, greenlit the movie.
Right.
So he read it, and he said, I want to star in it. And Brad said, Adam, we're ready to go. So, but I didn't see Judd being able to pull it off. I mean, again, this is arrogance at 22 years old. You know what I mean? Like, why would I ever say no to any opportunity like that? You know, it's like, you're so dumb when you're that age. I said, Brad, I don't see how he could pull it off. Because I picture Judd Nelson in The Breakfast Club, and he was like a tough guy.
Yeah.
And the character that he'd be playing is like the most crippling nerd yeah. you could possibly imagine. So Judd agreed to audition for me, right? Which was very nice of him. I didn't realize at the time how magnanimous that was of him. Mm-hmm. So we went to a bunch of different open mic nights at comedy clubs around town, and he was in disguise. And he's supposed to be the worst stand-up comedy. He's supposed to be like the worst stand-up comedian in the world, right? Yeah. Insecure, nerdy, poor delivery, bad jokes. He's just supposed to be like the worst. That's kind of what it's about. And so he would go up on these open mic nights and do the worst possible job, you know, the worst yeah. sets. And he was so committed to it. I thought, oh, he could totally pull this off. So once he said yes, the movie was going, which was so exciting. Yeah. And then we got all these other great people because it was a very unusual script on purpose.
Right.
You know, I knew when I was writing it, I'll never afford big explosions. I'll never afford special effects. I'll never be able to afford anything. Mm-hmm. How can this movie stand out from all the other movies being made? If I make it unusual enough
right.
that it might raise some eyebrows and make people talk about it because it's weird, mm-hmm. that I figured could be production value unto itself. So, and because it was the kind of script that most of the time doesn't get made, and most of the time these folks never get offered, we got lucky and got Bill Paxton and James Caan and Wayne Newton and a bunch of other people.
Did you? What was it like working with James Caan? I mean, were you intimidated at all? Or
I was intimidated, but you know, he it's so funny. He's an intimidating guy.
Yeah.
And the first thing I had to discuss with him was he wanted to do his character in a Yiddish accent, and I didn't want him to do that. By the way, he does a great Yiddish accent, but it was too shticky. I didn't want it to be.
I just want to see the scene of that happening. It's like it's your first big movie, and Jimmy just wants to have a word with you.
That's what happened. He took me into his trailer and he said, "Look, I want to do it. I want to do it like this." He's like doing the Yiddish accent.
Yeah,
and I said, I don't think we should do it like that. Mm-hmm. And he gave me this angry look. He's like, you don't like the Yiddish accent. I just don't think it's right. All right, fine. We won't do it with the Yiddish accent. He was great. By the way,
were you relieved?
I was so relieved that because by the way, it was such a favor of him to show up in the first place.
Yeah.
I thought he was just going to get on his motorcycle and drive away. So, but he didn't. He did it. He did. He worked he worked a few days, and he was great in the movie.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever seen it.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think he's ever seen it.
Well, we should screen for it. And then what about Wayne Newton? Were you a Wayne Newton fan?
He's the best. Well, we offered Wayne Newton a cameo.
Right.
Thinking, God, we'd be lucky to get Wayne Newton in a cameo. And he read the script and said, I want a bigger part. And so he said, I want to play the talent agent, which we never in a million years thought he would agree to do.
Yeah.
So that was a dream.
Uh-huh.
He said that to us. So that was great. Bill Paxton, we didn't know, but we knew his work. I mean, he was so funny in Near Dark and so funny in Aliens, and I was such a big fan. We offered him the part. He wasn't sure if he wanted to do it. We had a meeting with him. We all had so many laughs. He agreed to do it. He was such a, just the best guy of all time. We maintained such a close friendship over all the years. Mm-hmm. And he was such a big supporter of that film.
You know,
he was so vocal about that. And Lara Flynn Boyle, I knew because she went to my high school in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got everybody.
So I want to, just right around this time, because I just think it's, again, it sounds like a made up story that you were hired by Fox to do a script of Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
And then it just like...
Well, what happened was Cassian Elwes, who had produced with Brad...
What year is it? Just so I know...
This would have been... God.
Just to get a reference. Because the Planet of the Apes... When was the last Planet... I mean, before the whole reboot... It ended in the 70s,
and we pitched our reboot before the word reboot existed in probably 88.
Yeah.
88, roughly, you know?
So that's 87, amazing. 88. That's very prescient.
Yeah. So Cassian Elwes and I went to Fox and pitched this idea to reimagine Planet of the Apes. And it was based on the fact that we had, that Cassian had been making all these low budget movies and I had made Never on Tuesday, and that we knew how for very little money to make a movie look like a real movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so my idea was to do just forget all the sequels, open the movie with the last 3 minutes of the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then you cut to black and you fade up on a card that says, 300 years later, and it's the apes having reached their Roman era, right? And so now you've got, basically, I wanted to do Spartacus,
right?
But the humans are the slaves, and the apes are the Romans, and one of the descendants of Charlton Heston mounts a revolt. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to be Spartacus, I wanted it to be Satyricon, I wanted it to be Aliens. We used Aliens as sort of a... I hit the microphone, sorry. I used Aliens as a reference to them in the pitch, right, saying, look how big Aliens looked for such a small amount of money. And Jim Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd came from Corman and we're kind of in the same school of independent filmmakers, and we're going to do the same thing with Planet of the Apes. That's part of how we sold it to them.
Did you think at all about the costumes? I mean, again, there was no technical...
It was all going to be the old school way, we were going to have Rick Baker do the makeup, you know, and it would have looked awesome.
And it was such a great idea. So then what, were you shocked when you're like, wait a minute.
This was my first 20 years this later. Was my first life lesson in Hollywood. I thought for sure, okay, I just made my first movie at 20. I'm about to reimagine Planet of the Apes for 20th Century Fox at 21.
Oh my God.
I wrote the script. The head of the studio read the script, loved it. His only note was, can you trim it down about 10 pages? It reads just a tad long. Mm-hmm. That was our notes meeting. Mm-hmm. I mean, that never happens, right? So we were starting to open offices. It was really starting to take shape. This was going to be our next movie. And then he got fired, the head of the studio. And so all his projects got shelved. And then we continued throughout the years to try and reignite it, but never with any luck. And then Planet of the Apes changed hands a number of times after that. Oliver Stone was going to do it at one point. Chris Columbus was going to do it. James Cameron was going to do it. And then what ultimately got made was the Tim Burton movie.
Right.
Which was... and then everything was scrapped, and now the new reboot of Planet of the Apes is its own complete animal.
Yeah, it's a whole CGI. Yeah, it's a completely different kind of a thing. God, that must have been, but that one must have been disheartening.
It was, I mean, to understate things slightly, it was very, very heartbreaking.
It's terrible. Well, do you think everybody in show business has those things where you're like, I pitched that show and now it's on television?
I guarantee you everybody does. The difference is...
But that's huge.
But what you never want to be, right? I mean, I'd never have done this with that project. I mean, they own the property. But you can't be the guy that says, hey, I had that idea, they stole my idea, and then be the guy who sues them because your idea was stolen, even though you've never met them and they never read your script.
Right.
Ideas are out there in the universe. I mean, yeah. People have similar ideas all the time.
Yes.
You know, so that just is how it works. Plus, that was a very lucrative franchise for them. I mean, it was going to get reinvented at some point by somebody.
Yeah. You know? But I understand. I got that lesson too early on of like, you can't not go in if you're up for a job and pitch your best stuff and worry about that.
They're going to steal it. No, you just got to do it. You just got to bite the bullet. People are going to, and sometimes people are going to steal your stuff.
Yeah.
I've had meetings where I've gotten hired to write something and the executives will say in the room, okay, you've got the job, but some of the other people who pitched had some ideas we liked. Use these ideas.
Right.
And that's not necessarily cool, but it's also, that's happened to me where I pitched stuff and they've used it and I didn't get the job. So
right.
That's kind of just the way it works.
Yeah. You know? I guess that's being a professional.
Yeah. I think it is. Yeah.
You know, which is, it's not easy.
I'll tell you, my agent, the great Alan Gasmer, who is now a great producer, produces the show Vikings, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
When he was representing me, he said, because I said to him once, I had some meeting where I had these horrible notes that were just going to ruin the movie. And he said, and this was just a writing job. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like different kinds of mindsets for different kinds of jobs. Like if I'm doing a writing job that I know I'm not going to direct, mm-hmm. I'm in studio writing man mode. You know, my job is to deliver what they need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm directing an independent film, I'm going to fight for every detail because I'm the voice, I'm the filmmaker.
Right.
But if I'm writing something for hire, they're paying me, you know? Mm-hmm. So if they want to screw it up, fuck it up. I mean, I can swear, right?
Yeah.
If they want to fuck it up, that's
right.
Their, you know, if I don't do it, they'll hire someone else to do it. Anyway, so he said, it's better to not argue in the room
mm-hmm.
and to be somebody that they like to work with, because they'll forget if that project doesn't get made or if that project isn't successful. They'll forget those details, but they'll remember if you're easy and fun to work with or an asshole to work with.
Right.
So you don't want to be the guy in the room who's fighting them on every note.
Right.
Because that's just not very collaborative. You know, it's just not in the spirit of collaboration.
And so give me an example. And I mean from this for me too, because I've been, you know, when someone gives you a horrible note, and I'm not being facetious here, what is the language that you know, like your face is frozen and you're thinking that's the worst idea. Well, but what is the actual language? What are some, like somebody taught me something to say, which was, let me think about that.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. What I always would do in those meetings is I wouldn't be committal in any way. I'd say, let me think about all these, let me digest these, let me get back to you with some solutions, some options.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of times they have ideas, but they're not necessarily vested in that specific idea. They have a problem with the script,
mm-hmm.
and then it's your job to sort of decipher what the problem is
right.
based on their solution. Mm-hmm. And if their solution isn't good, you can sort of dissect, all right, well, the reason they came up with this solution is because this is their problem. And if I came up with a better solution, they'll 9 times out of 10 rather have the better solution.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say, I thought this through and I think that part of the problem might have been this. So what about this solution instead? And most of the time I've found that they've been amenable. Other times they just say, no, do it the way I said, or I'll hire someone else to do it. And then you know that situation is, that's the way that one is going, unfolding, you know?
What about when you know, I've been in a situation where I've been a writer producer of something where you know that it's the wrong path, but I've tried both. I've tried arguing and lost.
Yeah.
And then I've tried playing along like, oh, okay, let's make this the world's crappiest, pedestrian dialogue. And that didn't work either.
No. Well, I've had writing jobs where there comes a point where, I mean, everything I go into, I go in with the hope it's going to be great. I do my best work all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Best I can do all the time. But sometimes there comes a point where you know, okay, this is going in a direction that will never get made. Or if it does, it's going to be terrible. And you can either back away. I mean, that's perfectly fair. You know what? I can't, and I've done that too. I can't quite figure out how to make these notes work. You're probably best to do it with someone else. Or you just click into mercenary mode And you just say, is that, if that's the way you want it, that's how I'll deliver it. I'll have the script to you by Tuesday. And you just do that. I mean, there's no wrong way.
Right.
It's whatever you can stomach, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting for people, since we're talking about, you know, solutions for writing. Now we must, we've got to talk now about Detroit Rock City.
Okay.
Another passion. Do all of your movies become cult films?
You know, no, but it seems like a bunch of the movies that I've made have become cult films.
I feel like the Burt Reynolds movie is already got cult written.
That'd be great. I mean, the thing I like about the term cult is it means people have discovered it and like it,
and love
which is nice.
And support it.
It also implies that it was a failure when it initially came out, which, you know, that's...
I did a show for TCM, which was called Second Looks, uh-huh. and so much of it was a misunderstanding of cult films. You know, for instance, like, everybody thought 1941 was a bomb. It actually wasn't a bomb. It just wasn't, it didn't make the money that Jaws did.
Yeah.
But so how it, there's this revisionist history, and sometimes it's the timing of the film and things like that. Every movie I've been in is a cult film. or it was a huge hit in France. So Detroit Rock City, which does not seem like it would have been a cult movie. But then later became...
Well, it's got...
As you were making it, they threw money at you, didn't they?
Well, here's what happened. We were making this teen coming-of-age comedy.
Very much like a John Hughes movie.
Very much like it. Set in the 70s. Yeah. For those who don't know, it's about four kids in 1978 trying to sneak into a Kiss concert, and everything goes wrong along the way. And we kind of likened it ourselves to the... quest for the Holy Grail, and the Kiss tickets are the Holy Grail for these kids. So we had a blast making it, and I really loved recreating that era because I grew up in that era and I really have a nostalgia for it, and so that was fun. The movie, when we got all the Kiss songs very inexpensively, because Gene Simmons was one of the producers of the movie. Mm-hmm. That was kind of part of how it... I mean, that's essentially how it got made.
Yeah.
Which is that the way it all started was I was making a movie called The Chase with Charlie Sheen and Christy Swanson, which has also gone on to become a cult film. And the assistant editor wrote Detroit Rock City on spec and said, "Will you read this?" And I read it and I said, "This is great." He said, "If it gets made, will you direct it?" I said, "Of course I will." But I thought to myself, this will never get made. Gene Simmons would never agree to this. All the Kiss songs and the Kiss in the movie, it'll never happen. Anyway, and they weren't together or anything, Kiss. Anyway, as the years went on, Gene Simmons became involved with the project, attached himself as a producer. Kiss reunited for a big reunion tour. It was a big monster hit. And he was offering up all the songs to be used on the soundtrack. And suddenly all these pieces, all the planets aligned.
Yeah.
And we got to, in the movie, suddenly was a viable entity. And one of the other producers who was involved, just by happenstance, was a woman who I happened to have been dating at the time, named Kathleen Haas. And she said, "Hey, one of the projects I'm doing is getting pretty close. It's looking pretty good. I think we might actually get this one set up. And we were thinking maybe you'd want to direct it." And I said, "What is it?" She said, "It's called Detroit Rock City. It's about four kids in 1978. I said, "Stop right there. Not only have I read it, but I've already attached myself to it. So yes, I'll be happy to direct it." Anyway, New Line Cinema agreed to fund it. It all happened very fast.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great time making it. And then in post-production, all the money for the music went basically to Gene Simmons for the Kiss songs.
Yeah.
But it was a very low... I mean, this is going to sound like a lot of money to people, but the music budget for the songs was $500,000, right? So, and that's for all the Kiss songs.
Right.
Now, that may sound like a ton, but for famous hit songs, that's not that much money, especially for the amount of Kiss songs we needed. So, but in the rough cut, we put every other song from every other act from the era that we thought would be cool in the movie... We just put it all in just because we thought, let's put our wish list in for the test screening, and then we'll take it all out when we know we can't afford it and we'll figure out what to do. So the test screening went so well, Bob Shea said to then head of music at New Line, Toby Emmerich, "Pay for all the songs." So the music budget went from $500,000 to $2.5 million in one phone call.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But then the movie bombed. But then it became a cult classic. So.
But and how, if it's not too painful for you, how quickly did you know that it wasn't doing well? Do you just know after the first weekend? You can't figure it out?
You know the first Friday afternoon of the first weekend. They have a formula.
How do you go from like an amazing test screening? That must be heartbreaking.
That's well, you know, you mentioned earlier, you just have to be a professional. You know, I mean, that's just Hollywood. We all had high hopes that it was going to do great. And it just, by the way, we had a fantastic premiere. I mean, the studio paid big bucks for the premiere, which is always a good sign that they're confident in the movie.
Yes.
Kiss performed at the premiere, full Kiss concert with fire effects. Cheap Trick performed at the Kiss at the premiere. The premiere was a live event on VH1. They did a VH1 special, the Detroit Rock City premiere. We'll be back.
What year is this again?
This is 98. I guess 98, roughly.
Okay,
maybe 99.
All right.
I don't remember if
just trying to figure out.
I don't remember if we made it in 98 and it came out in 99. Yeah. Maybe. Anyway, so but then it opened and it just didn't perform. But we joked at the time that well, it'd be great if it became a cult classic, wouldn't it? And then it kind of did. So that's nice. Here's what happened. Aside from a million other things that happened, because it's always a million things. But at the time it was coming out, the philosophy was that Kiss were such icons,
mm-hmm.
and Gene Simmons' face is such an iconic face, that they were going to sell it the easy way, which was going to be the Kiss movie, right? Uh-huh. And we all felt... You know, the Kiss fans already are going to see it.
Right.
They already know it's there.
Mm.
We think you might want to sell it to everybody else but Kiss fans, make it not seem like the Kiss movie at all.
Right.
But that's a harder one to pitch to outlets because, okay, we can sell this as here's the easy way, Gene Simmons' face on the cover of a big magazine or... Right. Here's this coming-of-age movie set in 1978, and blah, blah, oh, yeah, and Kiss is in it, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So they sold it like a Kiss movie, and one way one might analyze it could be that the Kiss fans all came, and nobody else came because they weren't Kiss fans. They thought it was the Kiss movie. And then when it started playing on cable, and it started coming out on home video.
That's when I discovered it.
That's when everybody discovered it. And everybody at the time who discovered it was saying, oh, this isn't like Kiss at all. You don't have to be a Kiss fan to like this movie. And it really kind of organically built this fan base.
Yes. And in fact, my brother did a, when I went to school, my brother reenacted, they did a Kiss concert in high school. It was the closest theatrical. And I remember it was like a big deal. It was one of those insane moments where you're like, they're not Kiss. And people are, you know, like in a rural high school, people are like, they were, you know, they were so, people were so into it. They're miming, you know.
That's so funny.
It's that was the excitement of Kiss. Okay, so now, because we're running
can I just say one quick thing?
Sure, please, say anything.
Speaking of The Dark Backward and speaking of Detroit Rock City.
Yes.
Coincidentally, there is a theater in Brooklyn called the Alamo Drafthouse Brooklyn. Now, we all know the Alamo Drafthouse theater franchise.
We do. They promoted part of my book tour.
Fabulous.
We love them.
So the Brooklyn chapter, out of the blue, recently reached out to me and said, can we do a double feature in January? It's going to be January 31st, Detroit Rock City and The Dark Backward. So I'm flying to Brooklyn for that.
Oh, my God. That's great.
So I would love it if people came to see it.
We're live. People are going to come. Say the date one more time.
January 31st, Detroit Rock City is first, and Dark Backward is second. I'll be there for Q&As for both films, and you can buy tickets on the Alamo Drafthouse website. It's the Brooklyn Alamo Drafthouse.
Were you? Did you like the Disaster Artist? Did you follow The Room all of that?
Loved it.
That
kind of was fabulous, hilarious. You know,
yeah, that love, crazy love of making movies.
Loved it.
Okay, I want to get into some of your current. We don't. I'm running out of time. Mouse Hunt.
Yes,
I was almost in Mouse Hunt.
No kidding. You would have been great.
They couldn't make a deal with me.
Damn. Well,
that's your middle name.
They couldn't make a deal with me. And I met Gore. And guess what? Here's another little inside tip. The reason Christopher Walken's in the movie
is because of you.
Yours truly.
Here's what's funny. For the longest time, everybody involved was saying, God, wouldn't it be great if we could actually get Christopher Walken for this role? Thank you for that.
On behalf of
Team Mouse Hunt.
I wish I had met you. I met Gore. He was great. Yeah, and great. I had just worked with Chris in the movie called Search and Destroy.
Sure.
And they kept saying, And I was like, I want to do it. It's really funny. It's a farce. He said, well, we want to get Christopher Walken. And I was like, I just did a movie with him. I'll get you together. And I actually coached him on what to say to Christopher Walken to get him to do the movie.
That's so great.
And guess what my reward was?
What?
They offered me scale to be in the film. And I said, don't you think that's a little mean?
Yeah.
And they said, take it or leave it. Jennifer Tilly wants to do the movie. That's what they said.
Is a cold.
And I was really hurt by that. I said, really, scale? Like, that's it? You can't do any better than scale? And they said, take it or leave it.
Damn. Well, had I known that, I would have made some calls and would have had no effect on anything, but at least we could have shared that moment.
Well, it was funny because it was one of those things, too, as an actor, you learn your lesson. It was like, you'll see, they'll come back. Now, guess what? They didn't.
Oh, no.
They didn't. And now every time it's on, I'm like, I could have been in that movie.
Damn. Red bastards.
Okay, so that's Mouse Hunt. I got my, not that I'm bitter at all. and I always quote John Milius, no grudge is too small.
That's what he told me.
So tell me, we got to get to Giuseppe Makes a Movie. What the heck
yeah.
is that? I tried watching, they're a little rough, but it falls into the disaster artist
Giuseppe
genre a little bit.
Giuseppe Andrews is to call him a do-it-yourself filmmaker, a maverick filmmaker, that implies something that Giuseppe doesn't necessarily fit into. He lives in a trailer park. He has a prosumer camcorder. He's made hundreds of feature films starring all the homeless people that live around the trailer park that he lives in, the residents of the trailer park he lives in, the craziest movies you've ever seen. And I thought to myself, and the stories he would tell about making these movies was so not only funny, but I always felt kind of touching because he would take these outcasts, I mean, real homeless people, addicts, I mean, people that you would walk on the other side of the street, you'd avoid. And he would say, hey, you want to be in a movie? And he would use them in all these movies. And they became this little family of this little filmmaking family. And he would treat them with such dignity and such respect. And they became these creative collaborators with him on mm-hmm. these crazy little movies. And these movies meant so much to these people. And he'd pay them in beer, you know, or drugs or whatever.
Hey, that's my routine. No.
I wanted to make a movie about that little unit that he created with these people. And that's what the documentary is. It's called Giuseppe Makes a Movie. If I may be so bold, it has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh,
I'll say prior to that, I was the first person to say disparaging things about Rotten Tomatoes.
It's
killing the industry. But then when I got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, I thought, you know, Rotten Tomatoes isn't that bad.
It is. It's very bad. I never read a review of a film before I see it. I like to see the film and then I do the reviews. And then tell us about the last movie star with Burt Reynolds. And
so this is my current film.
Yes.
We just finished it. It premiered this year. Oh, excuse me. It's now 2018.
Yes.
So it premiered in a few months back at the 2017 Tribeca Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out this year, 2018. It is about an old man who used to be a huge movie star,
mm-hmm.
but now finds himself looking in the rearview mirror at his glory days, which are long behind him. And he's invited out, and he leads a solitary life. He's definitely not famous anymore. He doesn't have any of the power he had over women. He's invisible.
Mm-hmm.
He's invited unexpectedly, out of the blue, to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from a big film festival in Nashville, Tennessee. And his best friend, played by Chevy Chase, encourages him to go. Says, this is exactly what you need. This is going to turn your career around. this is a, I've heard of this film festival. It's a prestigious film festival. You should absolutely go. So he gets very excited. He goes thinking that this is going to be this big event. Mm-hmm. That's going to, you know, this big honor. And it turns out it's this little tiny film festival that's a bunch of film nerds that show movies in the back room of a bar. And they're so thrilled and shocked that this idol of theirs showed up, because mm-hmm. nobody else ever has. And he's humiliated that he actually agreed to come. And it becomes this sort of weekend soul-searching journey where this event kind of kickstarts this. He goes back home to Knoxville, where he sort of visits these landmarks of his past. Mm-hmm. And what started out as a very embarrassing weekend, the events force him to find some sort of redemption. I mean, I don't want to sound too buzz termy, but
right.
You know. But anyway, so I wrote it specifically for Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds, my childhood hero. Loved Burt Reynolds growing up. And I always thought Burt Reynolds was a great actor, but I never felt he got his due as a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
His contemporaries are all seen as great actors, but he was always seen as just a movie star. And those are two different things, as you know. But if you look at movies like Deliverance and The Longest Yard, he's a great actor. And so I wanted to write him. And I also thought to myself, if somebody doesn't write him a fantastic role at this point in his career, people may not remember how great he is until it's too late, potentially. You know. So I decided I'm just going to roll the dice. I'm going to write a movie for Burt Reynolds, a role that he's really going to want to sink his teeth into. I didn't know if he was willing to work anymore. I didn't know if he was retired or what.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the script and we sent it to his manager. And I said to the manager, I wrote this movie for Burt and Burt alone. And if Burt doesn't want to do this, I'm not making the movie. And that was true. I only wrote it for Burt. So he said, I'll send it to him. I can't tell you what he's going to say. He's Burt. So the next day, I get a call from Burt Reynolds. Now, we've all met famous people. And sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's not. But every once in a while, there's that one person that can make you starstruck, you know? And Burt Reynolds is that person for me. When I think of Burt Reynolds, the term movie star to me is synonymous with Burt Reynolds. I don't think of anybody today who is as famous as Burt Reynolds was when he was the biggest movie star in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So he said to me, he said, you know, this, because the movie kind of parallels Burt. I wanted it to I purposely wanted it to parallel his very public ups and downs and the mm-hmm. mistakes he made. It's about a character very much like Burt who has to come to terms with his mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, if you had sent me this script 10 years ago, I don't know if I would have wanted to face what it's about. He said, but now I have to do it. And he said, I'm in. And so that was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Then it took 7 years to get the money. But
oh, God.
But we finally made it. And he's so good in it.
Aww.
His performance is absolutely beautiful, completely vulnerable performance.
Mm-hmm.
So brave. And it's exactly what I hoped it would be.
And what was the biggest thing that surprised you about working with him on the set?
Well,
you admired him on the screen.
I was very pleasantly, I wouldn't say pleasantly surprised, but I was pleased at how collaborative he was. And he did not walk on the set and say, I'm Burt Reynolds, I know how to play this role, just sit back and learn. You know, he did not, it was nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we're making this movie together, I need you, you need me. You know, I'm going to give you the most I can, but if I'm not giving you what you want, kick my ass, tell me what you want, tell me I'm doing it wrong, tell me you hate it, whatever you want, mm-hmm. I need to give you what you need. He was so honest about that kind of stuff. That was really, I was touched by that, mm-hmm. you know? And I still couldn't get over the fact that he was there at all. I've worked with famous people before and it's always fun. Not always fun. Those are stories I tell you in private. But you know, when people recognize Burt, because he doesn't go out, you know, he lives in Florida. You don't see Burt Reynolds out a lot. When people would recognize him, they go insane.
Right.
Is that Burt Reynolds? Oh, my God. People go insane. It's fun to see, and he loves it.
Aw, well, what a great... And when does that one come out?
So that comes out later this year.
Okay.
It was bought at Tribeca by a company called A24.
Yes.
Which is also released The Disaster Artist this year.
Oh.
They got some great movies out this year. The Disaster mm-hmm. Artist, Lady Bird, The Florida Project. They're wow. fabulous.
Yeah.
They released Moonlight.
Good company.
Yeah. Great. So they bought it at Tribeca. They're releasing it this year. They don't know the exact date yet, but they're going to announce it soon. Mm-hmm. But anyone in the Southern California area on January 14th, if you feel like taking a trek out to the desert, it is the closing night film of the Palm Springs Film Festival.
Okay.
So,
wow.
So I don't know how many people within the sound of my voice are near Palm Springs, but if you are, January 14th, Palm Springs Film Festival, I'll be there, closing night film. Please come say hi.
Tickets are available online for that.
Well, they that's are. Exciting. I can't wait to look for that. The God, there's so many. Well, you have to come back, and we've barely scratched the surface.
I would love it.
Of your, have I forgotten anything? Have I missed?
I think you hit all the highlights.
I would
come back and hit the lowlights.
I'd want to ask more questions about you know Burt Reynolds, or did you have a low? What was your low point? You have any like? I'm always any con
with Burt.
No, I don't mean conflict like.
Well, I'll tell you.
Never shoot yourself in a corner or.
No, I'll tell you this. Bert is the first person to tell you. I mean, he walks with a cane because he needs it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he played football. He was a stuntman. Mm-hmm. And all those broken bones and all those injuries have caught up with him.
Right.
And so he's in a lot of physical pain. And he'll never tell you he's in pain, but you can see he's in pain.
I see.
And so I just felt bad that. And he also had a public battle with pain pills. So he can't take pain medication, mm-hmm. you know? So seeing him in pain hurt me. It hurt me to see, you know? But he never lets you know that he's in pain. But, you know, I have the earphones on and I hear him between takes. Oh, and so, you know, and we talked about it, you know? And he said he's tough, you know, he can take it.
Right.
But it just makes me feel bad when I see him in pain. But, you know, I said we talked about it. He used it for the role,
right?
Beautifully, mm-hmm. you know.
I understand that. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. It's always touching to see actors that you. I mean, I love. I'm a sucker for any kind of redemption.
Me too. Me too.
Chad, and him in.
He
especially when it's an older actor. Don't you love seeing?
Absolutely.
Remember, like Peter Fonda and the Limey.
Loved it.
I love seeing older actors.
One of the movies that I watched just prior, again, to making this movie is Harry and Tonto, which is fabulous.
One of my favorite. Yeah. Like, the cat alone needs an Academy Award. Yeah. But Art Carney was so good in that one, too. Alrighty. Well, Alan, Alan. Oh, did you ever see the movie Sherman's March? I forgot to get to it. Bert has a little cameo in that.
Sure, I have seen that movie. Yeah,
another
crazy
quest of... Yeah. I don't know why I had to mention that. Just I had to get in one last thing.
You always have to get in the last.
I'm
word,
sorry.
Don't you?
It's the new year.
Look for Adam's film, the last movie star in theaters soon. He is at Adam Rifkin on Twitter and at Adam_Rifkin on Instagram. Also, you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper,
yes,
in bookstores and online. You should buy it. Check out our Facebook page. Like us on Twitter and all that stuff. The podcast website is ileanaspodcast.com.
That's right. What'd you think of our first live show of the new year? 2018.
I thought it was great.
Do you have any? What would my score be on Rotten Tomatoes?
100%.
Thank you.
100%. Do you have any? Do you do New Year's resolutions at all?
No, because I fail at them as soon as
them.
I
just do. I told you mine is my want to make matzo ball soup for Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner. I just do little ones.
Oh my God, that's a great one.
Right?
That's a great one.
That's all I want to do.
By the way,
a year.
Bert has stories about every. I know we have to go, right?
No.
Bert has stories about everyone. I mean, everyone.
Yeah.
But and between takes, I would just sit down
Johnny
and
Shore.
Say. Everyone.
So Sally Field.
I would just sit down between takes and say, okay, Vincent Price, go. He has great Mel Brooks stories.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a feeling we're alike in that way. That's all I do is like when I work with George Siegel or Buck Henry, like
fantastic.
They love it. We're on day three. They're like, oh, okay, Like what he, you know, George Siegel used to call me his biographer. He goes, it's my biographer. She got every secret out of me now.
That's great.
Anyway, thank you so much. As we always say on our show, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Sadly, today's the end. But thank you so much. You're so kind to come here.
Thank you so much. It was so nice to be here.
Please come back anytime.
I'd love to.
Thank you, everyone. Happy New Year.
See you next time, everybody.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.